Belgic Confession, Article 25, the abolishing of the ceremonial law. We believe that the ceremonies and figures of the law ceased at the coming of Christ, and that all the shadows are accomplished, so that the use of them must be abolished amongst Christians. Yet the truth and substance of them remain with us in Jesus Christ, in whom they have their completion. In the meantime, we still use the testimonies taken out of the law and the prophets to confirm us in the doctrine of the gospel and to regulate our life in all honesty to the glory of God according to his will. Now, there was a question after last week's class regarding kingship and especially the Messianic king. A question that asked, what's the connection between the Messianic king and the ceremonial law? Would you explain that a bit further and maybe develop it? Well, the point that I made last week was that when the great coming king arrives, the one predicted in the Old Testament, since kings are tied up with the law, such a great figure will change the law, including the ceremonial law. And David, great King David, made regulations regarding the ceremonial law in his reign. Just read the last few chapters of the book of 1 Chronicles. And then there was something that I want to add to last week. In the Old Testament, the kings were responsible for the temple, which was the holy place in the ceremonial law. The kings were responsible regarding the building of the temple. We talk about Solomon's temple, King Solomon, and Zerubbabel's temple. He wasn't a king, but he was a kingly figure of the royal line. We don't talk about high priest Zadok's temple. So the kings built the temple, and the kings were responsible for repairing the temple, such as kings
Josiah
and Joash. Josiah and Joash, easy to remember, the two words are very similar. And then the idea is that when Messiah the king comes, like Solomon, like Zerubbabel, he is going to build a temple, only a far more glorious temple. And we'll say more about that, not in this class, but in the future, though I think you already know. So the Messiah, as a king, not only as a priest, when Messiah comes as a great king, he's going to bring a change in the ceremonial law. Now you will have noticed that already in the top left corner, I've written the chapters that we looked at last week, which chapters, amongst others that we could have picked, teach and predict that the ceremonial law will be changed. It's not just the New Testament tells us that the ceremonial law is going to be changed. The Old Testament prophesied this too, and it did so in various ways. Genesis 49, the first of the passages we looked at, said Shiloh, a great king's coming. Deuteronomy 18, a prophet like Moses. And if Moses gave the law, including the ceremonial law, when a greater prophet than the greatest Old Testament prophet comes, he's going to give a word from God, a new law that's going to change things. Psalm 2, the great king on the heavenly Zion, who is God's son, he's going to change the law because he's going to save the Gentiles. So the law must be fitting for the Gentiles. Psalm 40 says that offerings and burnt offerings and offerings for sin, God would not, but God has prepared a body for this one who is speaking, and about him the whole book of God speaks. So he is going to come and bring in a better sacrifice, and the sacrifices were key also in the ceremonial law. Psalm 110, you tell me.
A new king and high priest.
Yes, thou art a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. So a Melchizedekian priest comes in. And then, well, obviously the old priesthood of Levites and descendants of Aaron was imperfect. And then he's also a king, and you couldn't be a priest and a king in the Old Testament. Another change. Isaiah 2 predicts the exaltation of the temple mount with the Gentiles streaming up to it and the law going out. And Isaiah 19 predicts an altar and a pillar in Egypt. How in the wide world do you square that with Deuteronomy 12, for instance, which says that you must only offer sacrifices in the one place God has appointed, which later was revealed to be the temple in Jerusalem? Now, in tonight's class, we're going to look at many more Old Testament passages. We're going to continue from Isaiah 19 and move all the way through from Isaiah to Malachi, if we get there, in biblical order. We're probably not going to spend as much time on each passage as we did last week because, and I'm hoping here, because those of you who are here last week have already got the idea. So we won't need to dwell on the passage, but you can see where we're going and things will click and make sense easier. So I'm going to write a second column over here. And this bit, do not erase, means
leave it alone.
Don't come in afterwards and wipe it out, or else I'll have to do this on the third class, because we're going to work with all the passages together, only I don't think we're going to get there in this class. Yeah. So let's continue with Isaiah, and we'll go to Isaiah 53. You know, you can hardly do anything in the Bible without ending up quoting somewhere or other Isaiah 53. We're going to look mainly at one verse in Isaiah 53, and this question, if you get it, will really please me. Isaiah 53 verse 10. Think now, what does this say about the ceremonial law and its abolition? Isaiah 53 verse 10 reads, "Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand." What is the key phrase in the connection of this class?
An offering for sin.
An offering for sin. And those four words, an offering for sin, just turn the nouns around, a sin offering. And actually, what's rendered here sin offering is what's normally translated a trespass offering, because sin, iniquity, and trespass are practically the same thing. So this is dealing with a trespass offering. Jesus Christ's soul, and here soul means his life, he's going to offer his life as a sin offering. And the sin offering is spoken of at the end of Leviticus 5, the start of Leviticus 6, and the start of Leviticus 10. So there's reference to it in chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Leviticus. That's the main foundational passage. So how does this show that the ceremonial law will be abrogated?
There's no more need for animal sacrifices, because this is the ultimate offering for sin.
Yeah. If the servant of the Lord, God's peculiar highest servant, spoken of in the 15 verses here at the end of chapter 52 and all of 53, if he comes and gives himself a trespass offering, what no? How could you add to that with the trespass animal offering of a ram? And then this trespass offering of the servant of the Lord is not legislated for in the ceremonial law as such in Leviticus 1 through 7. See, if here you've got a better trespass offering brought in than the ones that were already mentioned there, and this one isn't even mentioned there. So the trespass offering, killing a ram, becomes a dead letter, a pointless exercise. And then if one of the sacrifices goes, well, you can hardly keep the other five that are mentioned in the first seven chapters of Leviticus. And by the way, this reference, Isaiah 53 verse 10, is most similar to which passage that we looked at last week? That's why I summarized them for you.
Psalm 40.
Yes. Psalm 40. Now, there's another reference that you could bring in at this point from Isaiah 53. Verse 7. It says in verse 7, "He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth." Now, a lamb to the slaughter, that fits with it, but it's not exactly saying he is a lamb to the slaughter. It's saying he's brought as a lamb to the slaughter in that he doesn't open his mouth. And so it's not saying he's the sacrificial lamb as such, because it also says he's brought like a sheep before her shearers. But it's saying he's going to come silently And for a rational human being to come and die, it means he's going to come in obedience to the Father and offer himself as a sin offering. So that's Isaiah 53 verse 10. Even that chapter deals with the ceremonial law. We looked especially at verse 10 because it's a sin offering. But if you look at the whole chapter, take it in one piece. This one, he's going to come and he's going to deal with sins and be wounded for our transgressions and so on, bruised for our iniquities. And he is this one who grows up before God as a tender plant, dearly and beloved. And he, at the end of the chapter, he receives the spoil. You know, killing a few animals and sprinkling their blood can't hold a candle to that. So the ceremonial law just collapses under its own weight.
Yeah, people want to go back there.
And people do want to go back there. In fact, some people's future hope involves bringing it back in again. Let's turn to Isaiah 61. The first couple of verses of Isaiah 61. And the question here is that uttered in Acts 8. Of whom does the prophet speak? Of himself or some other man? Isaiah 61 verses 1 and 2. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all that mourn. The prophet here is speaking of
Christ.
And what Old Testament passage proves that?
What, New Testament passage?
New Testament passage, sorry.
Luke.
Chapter 4. Yes, the Lord's sermon based in this text in the synagogue of Nazareth. What is the reference to the ceremonial law in Isaiah 61, 1 and 2? Harder than Isaiah 53, verse 10.
It's the year of Jubilee.
It is.
But can you tell me this? Do you think that when Christ came, it was a year of Jubilee? And go anywhere knowing that?
I think,
I mean, to fit the promise, it shouldn't be.
That it doesn't have to fit the promise
no,
at all.
Okay.
No. I think the whole issue of whether this year is irrelevant. He is the one who brings the year of Jubilee, because he is the one who proclaims, as verse 1 puts it, liberty to the captives. And what's the proof from verse 2? To proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. So Christ comes and he trumpets, captives are free, and this is the acceptable year, the great year, the 50th year. Remember, like the Queen's Jubilee. Yeah. So the 50th year. Now, when was the Jubilee declared? What was the special day in the year? Leviticus 25 verse 9. This is handy. Remember, the Queen's Jubilee. Jubilee means 50 years, and the great chapter on the Jubilee is in Leviticus 25, which is half a Jubilee. I mean, it all helps to try and remember where all these chapters are found. Leviticus 25 verse 9. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. You're thinking, what was on the 10th day of the 7th month? Well, it goes on to say, in the day of atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. So here's the idea, that the day of atonement is the basis of the proclamation of liberty. And Christ fulfilled the day of atonement, as the book of Hebrews especially makes clear, by his atoning death on the cross. That's the objective atoning work, dealing with sin. And then liberty is proclaimed on the basis of that. And now the question is, if Jesus Christ fulfills the Jubilee, the great acceptable year of the Lord to proclaim liberty, who in their right mind, I might ask, would need a literal Jubilee? You know, when land reverts back to its original owner and that type of thing. I mean, it would be nice to get out of jail if you're in a jail, or it would be nice to be liberated from slavery. I mean, as a wee bonus. Yeah. And as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, if, speaking about Christians who were slaves, if thou mayest be free, use it rather. You know, take your chance, it's a good idea. But Christ is the Day of Atonement. Let's go to Isaiah 66. This is our fifth and final passage. You know it's our final passage because, well, Isaiah only has 66 chapters. Verse 19 reads, I'll give you a bit of a running commentary here. I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them. That is, the eschatological judgment is going to come upon the Jews, and then some are going to escape, a remnant. I will send them unto the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, that draw the bow, so aggressive, warlike peoples, to Tubal and Javan, to the isles afar off. And in the language of the Old Testament, these names, they're not like Edom, Moab, Babylon, Egypt. These are the farthest away countries. This is like saying, we're going to send them off to Timbuktu when you're 10 years old and you don't even know where it is, but you think, that must be an awful long way away. Well, we're going to send out these missionaries as Jews, Jewish missionaries, to go out to those ones who have not heard my fame, says God, neither have seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. That's mission work. The only passage in the Old, the clearest passage in the Old Testament that says that missionaries will go out to the pagan nations. Then verse 20 continues, and they, the Jews, shall bring all your brethren, the converts, out of all nations, for an offering unto the Lord out of all nations, upon horses and in chariots and in litters and upon mules, every form of transport that they can lay their hands on. Kind of like some of the Frenchmen in World War II when the Germans swept into France and everybody could see what was coming, and they were getting in their cars, and there were some with little wheel buggies for their children and putting their possessions. They're all heading south and west. Well, whatever you can get your hands on, bring these Gentile converts up to Jerusalem. They're coming up in litters and upon mules and upon swift beasts to my holy mountain, Jerusalem, saith the Lord, just as the children of Israel bring an offering and a clean vessel into the house of the Lord. And now it is the bit that we want to get to. And I will take of them, and that's like a genitive partitive, I will take some of them, referring to the Gentiles that are being brought up to Jerusalem, and I will take some of them for priests and for Levites, saith the Lord. Does that verse shock you? Do you see the power of that verse? I'm going to take some of the Gentiles and make them priests and Levites, because the Gentiles were just as holy. We have the same office of believer before God. There is full equality. This is the main way in which the Bible talks about equality. This is God's equality legislation, that all Jews and all Gentiles who believe in Jesus are fully equal. Yeah. And guess which group is out there trying to destroy God's own equality legislation? The premillennial and the dispensationalists. And we're all for this sort of equality legislation. And they want to bring the Jews back in their millennium so that we will be their gardeners. Because if you take things literally, that's what you end up with in Isaiah 61, verse 5. Strangers or Gentiles shall stand and feed your flocks, and the sons of the alien will be your plowmen and your vine dressers. Something to look forward to. So, full equality. All are going to be equally consecrated to God, so the Gentile, largely Gentile church, will be a kingdom of priests and Levites too. A priestly kingdom. And once the Gentiles are priests and Levites, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the ceremonial parts, they fall to their ground. And by the way, this is what I mentioned in an earlier class, contradiction. There are other passages which say that if you take them literally, there are going to be godly Jewish priests in the future. See? This is one of our major points against. I know we're throwing ourselves into eschatology a bit now, and we're going to cut it short. But if you take things literalistically, it not only brings you backwards, but it contradicts itself. It makes the Old Testament a contradictory book. Let's move to the second major prophet, namely Jeremiah. Jeremiah 3, verses 16 and 17. Jeremiah 3, 16 and 17. And as I read, think to yourself, what's the key part? Why is he reading this? These verses? And it shall come to pass, When ye be multiplied and increased in the land in those days, saith the Lord, they shall say no more, the ark of the covenant of the Lord, neither shall it come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they visit it, neither shall that be done any more. At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all the nations shall be gathered unto it, to the name of the Lord, to Jerusalem. Neither shall they walk any more after the imagination of their evil heart. The key phrase is... Sorry, Mary? Yes, the Ark of the Covenant. Someone could counter and say, ah, this is merely saying that the Ark of the Covenant is going to be lost when the Babylonians come in and take over the southern kingdom and destroy the temple, which was a fact that was lost at that time. But this passage isn't just saying that it will be lost. It is saying that there's going to come a day, verse 16 says, when it will not come to mind, neither will they remember it, neither will they visit it, neither shall that be done anymore. Four times, nobody's going to think about it, remember it, go up to visit it, talk about it. It's going to be a dead letter. And the idea is not because it was lost. The idea is nobody's going to talk about it because something far greater is going to come in its place. And if the ark was the most holy piece of furniture, and it was the piece of furniture which was in the Holy of Holies in the temple, and nobody wants to talk about it because something better has come, and the next verse, and that's why we read it, verse 17 says, all the nations are going to come up and worship the Lord, then, put all this together, God is going to do something. So it's something or someone who's going to be far greater than the Ark of the Covenant is going to come, so that the Gentiles are going to be saved. And in our day, who wants to go back to the Ark? The same ones. We'll say more about the Ark in connection with our next passage. Let's turn to Jeremiah 31. I dare say, if you'd given any thought, especially those here last week, I wonder what sort of passages we could bring up next week. This one may well have been in there. We're going to read the classic passage on the New Covenant, Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith the Lord. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts, and write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbour, and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. The most important piece of nomenclature here is the reference to the new covenant in verse 31. I will make a new covenant. And as the book of Hebrews explains, in that this covenant is called the new covenant, the covenant prior to us has just become an old covenant. Right? Verse 32 mentions that the old covenant was given in connection with redemption, when Israel was redeemed and brought out of Egypt. So there's going to be, with the new covenant, a greater redemption. Another contrast involves the law. The two tables of the law in the old covenant, a couple of things about them. Number one, they were written on stone. And this time the law is going to be written in the heart. And the second thing about the two tables of the law, where were they placed? In the Ark of the Covenant. So if God's law is going to be written in our heart, and we're not so much talking about tables of stone, and tables of stone which are put in the Ark of the Covenant, see how this fits with Jeremiah chapter 3, because there's a greater redemption and a greater covenant and a greater work of God's law putting it in our heart. And that means there's a greater work of sanctification, the law being written in our heart, that sanctification. There's a greater fellowship with God, because I'm going to be their God and they shall be my people, based on a greater work of sanctification and a greater covenant and a greater redemption. There's going to be a greater knowledge of God. They're all going to know me. And there's going to be a greater assurance of the forgiveness of sins in justification, because I'm going to forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sins no more. So here, with regard to the ceremonial law, we're especially thinking of what? You could say, if you want to talk particulars, those two tables of stone, the Ark of the Covenant. But remember, all the bulk of the ceremonial law was given in the Old Covenant in Exodus, and then it was a New Covenant. It's going to shake the whole thing. So this material is going to pass away. Let's come to Jeremiah 33, the passage we read together. Jeremiah 33 speaks of two famous families. Two famous families. The family of David, the king, and the Levitical priests, along with their sacrifices. And here's a very hard question. Does anyone know what on our website deals with this passage? Professor Henko has a Covenant Reform news article, or maybe two or three, on this, and it's online. Someone asked the question, what do you do with this passage? So if you want to hear more about it specifically, you can go online. Go onto the Covenant Reform news page and then look at the scripture texts. That's how you navigate. So this passage deals first of all with the family of David. David the king. Verses 15 and 16 say, in those days and at that time, I'm going to raise the branch. That's an Old Testament name for the Messiah. The branch of righteousness. He's growing up onto David. So he's a righteous branch from the household of David. He's going to exercise justice and judgment in the land. And then the church, Judah, will be called the Lord our righteousness, because righteousness will be imputed to the church. And the church, partaking of Christ's righteousness, will refer to even herself. The Lord our righteousness is made over to me. Okay? Then the question is, how can the Jews work with this passage? Because it says, verse 17, thus saith the Lord, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of David. How long have the Jews been without a king? Who was their last earthly king? Last letter of the alphabet. Zedekiah. Their last earthly king, that's 586 BC. So you're talking now 2600 years. And this passage says the Jews are never going to want a son of David to sit upon the throne. 2600 years. And it says, you may as well try and break my covenant with day and night, so that night will not follow day. Instead, you maybe have three nights in a row and then 4 days in a row. But that's never going to happen. How in all the world can they live with this? But we'll let that question hang there. We're more interested in the second family, the family of the Levitical priests. Verse 17 says, thus saith the Lord, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. And then our interest now, neither shall the priests, the Levites, that is, those priests who are Levites, the Levitical priests, they'll never lack a man before me to offer burnt offerings and kindle meat offerings and to do sacrifice continually. And then the next few verses says, if you can break my covenant of the day, my covenant of the night, so that day and night don't come in your season, then my covenant with David, regarding a king, and my covenant with the Levites, so that they'll have priests after their order, then that could be broken. And yet, do the Jews even today know who is a descendant of David? Do they know who the priests are? Do they know who the Levites are? They haven't had sacrifices now for coming on, well over 1900 years.
Stuart, could you just say something very briefly about the connection between a priest and a Levite? Because I've never got that clear in my mind.
Well, the Levites is anybody of the tribe of Levi. And then those who functioned as Levites were those who were of a certain age, and who were male, and who weren't disqualified for various reasons. Then the priests were a certain line within the tribe of Levi who descended from Aaron and then through Zadok. And this passage talks about the priests, the Levites. It means the Levitical priests. And then, by the way, bring in Psalm 110, which says, there arises a priest after the order of Melchizedek. That blows this passage out of the literal understanding of this passage out of the water too. So then the question is, where are these priests and Levites going to come from? And then verse 22 says, as the host of heaven cannot be numbered. How many stars are there? How many grains of sand are there in the beach? Just take Port Stewart, West Strand. How many have you got there? So will I multiply the seed of David my servant, and the Levites that multiply before me. Where are all these numerous priests? Vast numbers of them. If it isn't the Gentiles, who are the priests and Levites? And this reminds us of what passage we've already looked at. It says that Gentiles will be priests and Levites. Isaiah 66. Because as 1 Peter 2 says, we are a kingdom of priests. We, the largely Gentile church, are a kingdom of priests. Let's move to Daniel. What is the great chapter in Daniel for the passing away of the ceremonial law? It's also the most controversial passage in the whole of Daniel. Which controversy, myself being a very ironic man, I'm going completely to ignore. But if you do want to read a wee bit about it, Professor Engelsman has a pamphlet, and we'll set these over here. The 70 weeks, the time of prophecy. And we even have a sermon on that passage online. Anyone know who preached on Daniel 9, 24 through 27 in our church? Which sermon is online? Yes, Reverend Gary Ericks preached on it. So let's read this passage. 24 through 27 of Daniel 9. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks, and 62 weeks, the street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease, and the overspreading, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. To repeat, we're not going to deal with the eschatology here and premillennial dispensationalism and all that. We have the pamphlet. We're going to take the historic exegesis of this passage. We don't see all sorts of antichrists in the future coming to Jerusalem and reigning over it for 3.5 or 7 years and so forth. The passage itself refers to one great individual who stands out. There's one great individual who stands out in this passage. What is he called in the passage?
Messiah.
He's called Messiah, verse 26, and Messiah the Prince, verse 25. So we're dealing here with Messiah the Prince. Verse 24 says he does 6 things. The first 3 are negative, so to speak, and the next 3 are positive. He comes to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity. And remember, verse 26 says he's going to be cut off. So here the Messiah is going to come. And to put it in verse 26, he's going to be cut off, and in so doing will finish transgression, make an end of sins, and make a reconciliation for iniquity. And by the way, there's your sacrificial system gone again, of Leviticus 1 to 7 and many other places, of course, for it runs through the whole of the Old Testament. Then the next three things are positive. The first of them, which is the fourth in total, says that he will come to bring in everlasting righteousness. And this is the righteousness of God, which is everlasting, which is given to all who believe through the atoning sacrifice of Christ, the first 3 things, and through his perfect obedience to the law. And then it says, to seal up the vision and prophecy. So all the prophecies many of which were given in visions, he will seal them up because he is the fulfillment of them. And number six, he will, number six says, to anoint the most holy. And I take this reference to the most holy, not to be the most holy place, though you could say it's the most holy place, anointed in heaven. The book of Hebrews could be used in support for that. But it refers to the most holy one. Through his sacrifice, he atones for sin, the first three things. He brings righteousness and justification to all of his own. And so he fulfills prophecy, the fifth statement. And in this way, he himself is anointed as the most holy one. Because as Psalm 45 verse 7 says, the Lord anoints him with the joy of gladness above all his fellows as a reward for his perfect obedience for his life on earth. And let's go to verse 27. Verse 27 says, he shall confirm the covenant. Which of the passages that we've looked at so far does this make us think of? Which one stands out?
Jeremiah
31. And it says, in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. A reference to AD 70, because there is a prince who comes in here and destroys the city, the Romans, in AD 70. And when it talks about the sacrifice and oblation ceasing, the nearest passage we have to that, the ones we've looked at, Psalm 40. Now, let's move to the minor prophets, since the minor prophets come after Daniel, who's the last of the four major prophets in the arrangement in our Bibles. Think hard about this question. There's one book. I'm not now talking about a passage or a chapter, but I'm talking about a book as a whole. There's one book amongst the minor prophets that points toward the abolition of the ceremonial law in a somewhat unusual way. There's one book that questions the validity of the whole system. One book. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. You have a 1 in 12 chance. Philip?
I think it's Zechariah.
Zechariah, okay. You're wrong, but that was the second best answer, if that makes you feel any better. Probably doesn't, though. Yeah. It is, now you have to bear with me here, the book of Jonah. The book of Jonah, right? But think now. Admittedly, it's a wee bit of a stretch, or it's not so clearly obvious. But think about the conversion of the Ninevites, right? Were they circumcised?
No.
Did they go on a pilgrimage to the temple?
No.
Did they have animal sacrifices on the altar in Jerusalem? No. Did they submit to the Jewish priesthood? Did they keep the Jewish food laws? Now, admittedly, it's an argument from science. There's a whole lot of things we'd like to know about the book of Jonah and its surrounding issues. It is an argument from science, but, you know, are we really to think that 720,000 people, at a guess from the population, because it said there were 120,000 in the middle of the left and the right, and if it was a ratio of 5 to 1, then that would give you 720. Admittedly, some of them would be women, some would be too young to go up, but are they all going to go up all that way? Jonah didn't give them any legislation. It's a reference to the calling of the Gentiles. I know it's an argument from silence, but it sure fits with the New Testament reality of which this is pictures. Well, that's right. That's another issue. Yes. Let's move to Zechariah then. Let's move to Zechariah. Zechariah 3 verse 9. What statement are we particularly interested in here? Zechariah 3 verse 9. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the engraving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. That's it. I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. Now, somebody could say it's a bit of a hyperbole. But no, it's not when you think of the reality. Think of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. The book of Hebrews says repeatedly they had to have a Day of Atonement year in, year out, and they had to have sacrifices and they kept up, thus symbolizing that the sins were never really dealt with. But here, the sins And the iniquity that will be ruined one day. One day. Staying in the latter half of Zechariah chapter 3, here's one of the two main passages in Zechariah which teach that the king and the priest are united in one person. The king, of course, has to be of the line of Judah, the tribe of Judah. The priest has to be the tribe of Levi. You can't be both under the Old Testament system, as Uzziah found out to his leprous loss. But in Zechariah 3, verses 6 through 10, the same passage that talks about sin being removed in one day, verse 9, talks about one who's called the branch. The branch. And this branch, who is the king, as other passages make clear, is connected with Joshua the priest. Now, how they're connected, we'll say more when we get to the next passage, chapter 6. But it's this one who's the branch, verse 8, who removes the iniquity of the land in one day. But let's go to chapter 6. Chapter 6, 9 through 15. 9 through 15. Verse 13, Zechariah 6, verse 13, talks about one who is a priest and a king. It says, even he, the branch, verse 16, verse 12, even he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne. He's a king, and he shall be a priest upon the throne. So he's a kingly, priestly figure. And then it says, and the kingly priest will build the temple of the Lord. See, because you've got to be a king to build the temple of the Lord, and then priests function in the temple of the Lord. And then it says, the council of peace shall be between them both. And this passage historically has often been used in support of what doctrine? Who's been reading Herman Hoeksema's Reformed Dogmatics in the section on the covenant recently? Hoeksema has a lengthy section in there proving that the council of peace here is not a reference to the council of redemption and between the Father and the Son in eternity. He says when it says the council of peace shall be between them both, it means the council of peace. There'll be a peaceful relationship between the office of priest and king in one person. And he's dead right too, as a number of other exegetes have pointed out. So here's the idea then. The king and the priest together. Verse 11 says, take silver and gold and make them crowns. An elaborate crown. Sometimes it's a plural of majesty. And set upon the head of Joshua. So a crown upon the head of Joshua, who symbolizes here, he's a priest with a crown on his head, a king, symbolizes the priest king who's going to come. And this priest king who's going to come will build the temple, as we said in verse 13. And verse 15, it says, and they that are far off, the Gentiles, shall come and build in the temple of the Lord. There's a place in the temple of the Lord and its work for those who are far off, Gentiles, because one who's going to be a king and a priest is going to come. Chapter 3 says he's going to deal with sin in one day. Let's go to Zechariah 13. Zechariah 13. Zechariah 13, verse 1. In that day there shall be a fountain opened to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. What phrase am I thinking of here? Nope. Fountain. There's a fountain. There's a fountain that's going to deal with sin. And you think, where did Moses say there's a fountain that's going to deal with sin? You know, there's all these sacrifices and you sprinkle things with hyssop and the priest has got to look. But a fountain? A fountain come up out of the ground is going to deal with sin. And the reality of this fountain is Jesus Christ our Lord. Chapter 12, verse 10, only 4 or 5 verses before, says, I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplications, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. These are the Jews who are brought to repentance. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one is in bitterness for his firstborn. So here's one whom they've pierced, Christ. The Holy Spirit comes upon them, and then they're brought to repentance. And then verse 1 of chapter 13 says, and in that day, the day of the Messiah and his sufferings, the day of judgment and salvation, in that day there shall be a fountain opened. In that day. And by the way, that's the same day, the one day when sin is dealt with, chapter 3, verse 9. How does this fit with the ceremonial law? There's a fountain coming up. Well, it doesn't. And even we don't say there's a literal fountain that we've got to go to and wash in. It's a spiritual fountain which brings cleansing and refreshment to the people of God. That deals with our sin, its guilt and pollution.
Yeah? Presumably then, like the premillennialist would still view the majority of those verses as you have explained them, but they flip back and forward between things being fulfilled in Christ and things that are to be fulfilled when he comes back then. Is that they lose it?
Well, the key thing with the dispensation is literalism. But there are times where they'll say, well, it sort of refers to both.
Because Engelsman has an article on the Standard Bearer, and he says that these modern-day premillennialists are starting to get a wee bit kind of...
Yes.
Kind of tweak things a wee bit to make it... They're saying that, I think, that they're not in a certain agreement as they thought they were, but they're not prepared to come out and just kind of reject it. They're trying to kind of... a wee bit of jiggly boogly, you know, but it's not really working for them.
That's right. Yeah, the progressive dispensationalists. Yeah. Good, let's turn to chapter 14. The last two verses of the penultimate book of the Old Testament. Let's read Zechariah 14, verses 20 and 21. You could say, in effect, that the whole book builds up to this. In that day, a day of salvation... In that day there shall be upon the bales of the horses holiness unto the Lord. And the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the pots before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Can you see it? How in all the wide world can this fit with the ceremonial law? Let's go through it bit by bit. The bales on the horses, right? So here with this stallion, there's a bale hanging presumably from his neck and it jingles whenever it goes forward. And on the bale of the horses, there's an inscription. Holiness unto the Lord. What does that make you think of?
Aaron's golden crown really on his mitre.
Yes, the golden plate on the forehead of Aaron, which says, holiness unto the Lord. So in that day, holiness unto the Lord is going to be on the bales of the horses. This is an expansion and a spread of holiness. Then it says, the pots in the Lord's house, so temple pots, will be like the bowls before the altar. So the bowls of the altar, they're a holier pot used for a more special consecrated function, but... All the pots will be as holy as these pots. Then it says, yea, every pot in Jerusalem shall be holiness unto the Lord's host. Wow. So number one, they need more pots for the temple, because the ones in the temple aren't enough, so they've got to get ones from Jerusalem. And then number two, every pot will be just as holy. Right? Then it doesn't just say every pot in Jerusalem, it says every pot in Jerusalem. And every pot in Judah, the whole country, you could say, shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them. Right? Because 16 through 19 talk about all the nations coming up to Jerusalem. So you've got the salvation of the Gentiles spoken of here, and all these pots are going to be holiness, and they're going to use these pots for sacrifices, and they're going to boil and cook things in them. And in that day there will be no more Canaanite in the house of the day of the Lord. You see, Gentiles are coming. Expansion of holiness, not just in the temple, but to Jerusalem and to all of Judea in these pots. And holiness unto the Lord, not just on the forehead of the high priest, but on the bales of the horses.
What is that last bit saying, they shall no more? That would suggest the Canaanites are not allowed in.
Yes, it's talking about purity. Sometimes... impure people, pagans or even Jews, got in. And here it's saying, well, this will never happen again. It's going to be a greater level of sanctity. Yeah. So the ceremonial laws are going to be changed here. And the holiness distinction is breaking down. It's funny too that the more you get through the Old Testament, the more passages you can quote. Because you're getting near the fulfillment. Which brings us to the last Old Testament book. Julian knows where we're going to go in chapter 1. As we looked at it in the Tuesday class. What verse are we looking for in chapter 1, Julian?
11.
Yes, 11. Very good. Very good. Malachi 1 verse 11. You can't read this, but you think of the old soldiers, the cenotaph. For from the rising of the sun, even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. And in every place incense shall be offered unto my name, and a pure offering. For my name shall be great among the heathen, saith the Lord of hosts. Saith the Lord of hosts. And the words we're particularly interested in this verse, ceremonial law references
incense
and offering. And the offering are the beasts, and you could even probably throw into that some of the drink offerings and offerings of vegetables and so forth. These incense offerings and other offerings are, where are they offered? Where are they offered?
Every place.
In every place. So they're not just at the temple. And they're not just, think Isaiah chapter 19, they're not just going to be offered in Egypt. They're going to be offered everywhere. So you're going to have legitimate incense, and the incense could only be offered in the temple in Jerusalem, and even then only in one gold, to take the tabernacle reference, the gold altar of incense. But now it says incense should be offered in every place, from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same. And pure offerings, animals and beasts are going to be slain. We're all over the world. And you can't do that without changing the ceremonial law. And you can't have a priesthood that has to live in and around Jerusalem and the Holy Land that's going to offer these sacrifices if you're going to have some offered in Greenland and Chile and so forth. And you see, this verse 11 again says, Gentiles. The fulfillment here is not that we take this literalistically and go wafting around incense, which church is especially known for doing that, Eastern Orthodoxy. The incense which is offered, like Psalm 141 verse 2 in different places in Revelation, is prayer, sweets, goes up to God. Luke chapter 1, the altar of incense with Zacharias. And the offerings are the offerings of thanksgiving and worship, of which the Old Testament and New Testament says so much. That's Malachi 1 verse 11. Let's move to chapter 3. Malachi 3. I've fallen behind in writing things on the board. We can tidy that up later. Malachi 3, 1 through 4. Verse 1 talks about two individuals. One of them is the Lord, the messenger of the covenant, and the other one is my messenger. Who is the messenger of the covenant? Christ. And whom does Christ call my messenger?
John
the Baptist. Behold, I will send my messenger, John the Baptist, and he, John, shall prepare the way before me, Christ, and the Lord whom ye seek, Christ, shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come. So here's Jesus Christ and John the Baptist, and he comes to the temple. And why shouldn't he? Because he's the king. And then this messenger of the covenant, who's the Lord whom they seek, the one whom the believers delighted in the Old Testament, he comes and sits as a refiner and purifier of silver, verse 3, to purify the sons of Levi. And the sons of Levi here must be understood in the light of two other passages we've looked at tonight. Isaiah 66 and Jeremiah 33. Because remember, chapter 1 says that God's name will be great among the Gentiles, 1 verse 1, and they're going to offer a pure offering and incense unto the Lord, which are priestly duties. And then verses 3 and 4 says, at the end of verse 3, they're going to offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Verse 4, then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem shall be pleasant as it was in the days of old. Holy, thankful, godly people. And then finally, and I think with this we'll end. We won't get to tie all the stuff together. That'll hold over for next time. Finally, the last three verses of the last book of the Old Testament. The last three verses of the Old Testament. Malachi 4, verses 4 through 6. I'll read the bit about Elijah, verses 5 and 6 first. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Elijah is
John the Baptist.
He came in the spirit and power of Elijah, John did, according to Luke 1, verse 17, the words of Gabriel. Christ said, John is Elijah, if you're willing to receive it, Matthew 11, verse 14. John the Baptist, right? The Jews, in their many traditions, which aren't all coherent and which contradict each other in various ways, but the Jews, by and large, are looking for Elijah. And they're looking for Elijah to come to help them to understand the Old Testament and how they're going to keep, what they should be doing about sacrifices, and how do you make sense of this law, because they don't have the land, they don't have priests, although they say that the sacrifices are fulfilled with repentance and good works and so on, but they can't make head nor tail. They're looking somewhere to come and make sense of it all. Well, Elijah did come to help make sense of the Old Testament and the ceremonial law, because he pointed to Jesus Christ, who is the fulfillment of it. The fulfillment of the Old Testament, including the ceremonial law. That's verses 5 and 6. And then verse 4 says, the law of Moses, which includes the ceremonial law. Here's one of the parting commands of the whole Old Testament. Remember ye the law of Moses my servant, including the ceremonial law, which law I commanded unto him in Horeb, where the ceremonial law was given, for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. And the idea is that Old Testament Israel was to keep the law of Moses, including the ceremonial law, until the coming of Elijah, John the Baptist, and the coming of the messenger of the covenant, in whom ye delight, Jesus Christ, chapter 3, verse 1. And then Messiah will come, he will bring in a better age, and he will make sense of our law, and he will bring deliverance for all the people of God, Jews and Gentiles.